You're listening to Louisiana Insider, a superlative guide to a great state's destinations, hosted by Errol Labor, executive editor of Louisiana Life magazine.
It's our Louisiana song. It's our favorite melody. It's our Louisiana song. Hearing it echo through the cypress tree.
It's hard not to get pumped up to that, you know, even if you don't care about football or LSU, to go there and all that, you know. I mean, it's really some stirring music. I say fighting tigers, and we're going to be talking today a really interesting topic about a book. It's called Kingfish U, Huey Long and LSU, and it was about Huey Long's role as governor in building LSU, and just a lot of interesting politics and anecdotes. With me is Robert Mann. Well, I'm proud to say he's been a guest on this podcast a couple of times before because of his expertise on Louisiana politics. He's the author of numerous books, one called Becoming Ronald Reagan, The Rise of the Conservative Icon, and Backrooms and Boycotts, My Life in Louisiana Politics, and a lot of stories right there. Both the Manship Chair of Journalism in the Manship School of Mass Communications at LSU. Also, he's had a career that he's worked with John Breaux and Kathleen Blanco. And I mean, you were in Washington right there in the staff with Brian, with Russell Long.
Right, right.
You've been there, you've got a lot of stories to tell. And as you mentioned, you never got to mention Huey Long, but or know Huey Long, but you have known some of his family, including Russell Long. So, all right, I want to begin at the very beginning of your book. You mentioned James Carville, who we all know, and he's talking about the book and about this, and you're paraphrasing him, making, I think, a really interesting point, though, and that is that no public university is more important to the intellectual and cultural life of its state than LSU. So out of all the state universities out there in all the states, 50 of them, why is LSU, if you buy into this quote, more important to the intellectual and cultural life?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me on, Errol. It's great to be back, and I appreciate your kind words. I don't know that James is right. I think it would be hard to empirically prove that statement, but I think that
there's probably some truth in it somewhere.
Yeah, I think there's. I think it's certainly true that the LSU is enormously important to the social and economic, cultural life of Louisiana, and probably more so than other states. And I think that part of it is kind of was, you know, I think the book sort of demonstrates why that is, and that is that it's kind of hard to imagine being able to write a book and, you know, sustain, you know, write 300 plus pages of a book about the political role that a state university played and larger than life association that politicians like Huey Long had with that university and how they used it for political means, but also to gain a national reputation. You know, maybe Alabama is one of those, but that was, you know, I don't think that it. I think it would still be hard to say that Alabama is as important to Louisiana as LSU is, just because you know this. I think it's just because of the way that LSU dominates the state, and I think a lot of it is about football. A lot of it is about the affinity that so many people, even in North Louisiana, have for LSU, and how universities around the state that's in some ways resent LSU because they think that LSU gets a bigger part of the pie than they should. They still aspire to be like LSU. The other reason I think that, and this may be more what James was talking about, is that I think that the history of LSU is really the history of Louisiana's growth and maturation. I don't think we're where we need to be, but there's a tremendous amount of wealth, generational wealth, that's been created by the opportunities that, that young men and women have had to attend university at LSU from the, you know, the early part of the 20th century on. And it really has transformed a lot of lives. There's just a ton of generational wealth. Most of it, you know, all of it for the first, you know, 100 years was white, you know, white young men and women. But, you know, in the depths of the Great Depression, this university grew because of Long and his emphasis on it. But this university grew in the years of the Great Depression. The enrollment of the state university grew by 333% at a time when other universities were downsizing or losing enrollment. And the national average for increase in higher education enrollment during that same decade was 27%. So this state university found a way to make itself much more important to the people of its state in its darkest hours. And they did it through football, they did it through the band, they did it through making it a much better university than it had been just a few years earlier, and making it an aspiration for young people all over the state to come here. And so that's probably an insufficient answer, and it's certainly not, you know, based on any empirical data. But I think what James is saying is that there's no other university anywhere in the country, that a state university where the that has so many connections to so many parts of the cultural and economic life of that state.
They also did it through tuition. I mean, it wasn't LSU, was it free at the very beginning, or
if you were a Louisiana resident, you could come to LSU tuition free. You would just have to pay your room and board. So a student could come to LSU in the 1930s and live, you know, feed himself or herself and house himself or herself for about it depend on where you lived and how well you ate, but for between $600 and $900 a year. And if you went with a $900 amount, you were probably living like a king. So what LSU would do, what UE Long would do, and what LSU would do, was they would find jobs for these kids on campus or in town, and they were able to. A lot of them were able to make it. And if you came from out of state, which a lot of young people did too, it didn't cost you much more. It cost you $60. That was the out of state fee, and so it was a little more expensive, but a lot of young people from Mississippi came down here to go to school at LSU, and so it was really affordable. And again, this is in the depths of the Great Depression, and yet a lot of young people, the enrollment of this place just ballooned, and it wasn't because people had a lot of money. It was because LSU went out of its way to make it accessible.
So where was LSU getting the money? Was this at the time when, like, Huey Long was starting to tap the oil industry? Was that what was paying for it?
Yeah, well, so a lot of the money that was poured into this place was in the form of construction money. LSU was already getting about a $750,000 to $1 million appropriation from the state when Long became governor. That began increasing. But that wasn't the real. That wasn't the biggest problem that LSU had in those days. It was figuring out a way for the physical plant of the university to grow to accommodate all these young people who were coming. Housing was the biggest problem, but also just more academic buildings were needed. But housing was a huge problem, and your listeners may not be aware that the LSU campus in those days was split between the north, the old, what they call the old campus, which is where the state capitol is now, around the capitol grounds, mm-hmm. and this new campus where the LSU campus is now. And women were most basically attending and school, living on the old campus and taking a train down to the new campus. The cadets and men were generally living on the new campus, but to consolidate the two, they needed to build dorm rooms, especially for women, but also for men, to bring everybody together. And it took a lot of money to do that. And so Long started the building program here by selling property, LSU property, back to the state to build the Capitol, and sold a lot of it to the state highway department. These were kind of legally dubious, especially the highway department deal was kind of legally dubious, but it raised a lot of money in a short period of time and enabled LSU to quickly start building dorms and new academic buildings.
So the land that the Capitol is on today at one time belonged to LSU?
That whole area from all the Capitol stretching all the way down to where the State Museum is, the Pentagon Barracks, and then east several blocks away from where the Capitol is beyond the old insurance department building. That was all LSU property. But the problem was a lot of property, and it was sufficient to accommodate the smaller student body that they had in the late teens and early 1920s. But Governor John Parker, who was governor and from 1920 to 24, even before he became governor, he and LSU officials really decided that they were landlocked. The school, if it was going to be an agricultural school, it needed more land for agricultural experiments and that kind of thing. And so they began lobbying to expand the campus and move it. And they found this big piece of property, a former plantation, a couple of plantations down here, and bought that land in the early 20s. And ironically, at the time, Huey Long was running for governor in 1924, opposing all of this. He hated the idea of moving the campus to its current location. He called it John Parker's Temple of Vanity. And for whatever reason, it was not really entirely clear why he was opposed to it, except that he hated Parker, and I think that was probably the best explanation for it. But he went from being the biggest opponent of the new campus to being its biggest promoter.
And so so he wound up selling what was essentially state property to the state.
Yeah, he did, and he was told by the lawyer for the State Highway Commission, who was also his cousin, a guy named Jess Nugent. Nugent told him, we're all going to prison for this. this is not legal. And there were a couple of lawyers up in Shreveport who sued the state to try to overturn it, who thought it was improper and illegal. And Long told him they were going to do it anyway, and he agreed to sign, even though it didn't require his signature. He agreed to sign the resolution selling the property, and then he told James Monroe Smith, the president of LSU at the time, to get the buildings built as fast as possible, because I think Long's attitude was that if we can spend the money and build the buildings, it'll be fait accompli, and they're not going to come take the building away. And so that's what they did. And eventually the lawsuit faltered. The state did win the lawsuit. And for whatever, I don't know really much about why the judge ruled that it was a proper sale, but it might have been a prolonged judge. But for whatever reason, that never became a big problem.
People hear about Huey Long, and you would think he was in power for forever. But in fact, he was elected governor, in 28? And then didn't serve a full term as governor because he was elected to the Senate. So he served like three years as governor and then went on to the Senate. And then he was assassinated in 35. Is that correct?
So that's right.
It was only like 7 years that he was there and in power. Yeah. And did so much.
Yeah, and not only that, but I was just reminded last night by somebody. I was down in New Orleans speaking, and somebody, we were talking about how young he was. They couldn't believe that he was only 42 when he died. And so, when he became governor, he was in his late 30s. And, so you read these stories about Huey Long in my book and in T. Harry Williams' book and others, and you sort of forget that he was just a whippersnapper, bossing these older men around and really dominating them. And it makes it all the more remarkable to me.
Would the source of his power have been his access to money?
I think partly. I have always thought the source of Huey Long's power was his just sheer audacity. His unwillingness to abide by any existing rule or rule of decorum or any kind of even common courtesies. He bulldozed people, and he didn't really, he honestly didn't care what people thought about him too much. He knew where he wanted to go. He knew what he wanted to do. He was creative. He knew how to get things done. I think he had an innate understanding of human nature. He didn't have a college degree. He never studied psychology. He was pretty well read, but I think he had this innate understanding of human nature. He knew how to motivate people in a positive way and also a negative way. He wasn't afraid to use power. He had no compunctions about using power, and he had no compunctions about often going too far in using his power. But his son Russell told me on a number of occasions that he really thought that his father had a premonition or just this feeling that he wouldn't live to be an old man, and that he was I think the way Senator Long always described him, he was a young man in a hurry, and he was. And I think it was, whether he really had that premonition or not, but he certainly conducted himself like he didn't have a whole lot of time to live and get things done. And Senator Long always said, my father was a revolutionary. I'm more of an evolutionary. I think Senator Long knew he had more time, would live a longer life. So I think for all those reasons, he didn't have the money wasn't there in the beginning, to do what he wanted to do. He had to be creative in doing it. In those early days, when Long became governor, it was considered highly irregular to, sell bonds, basically go into debt to build a building or to, build a highway. It was always a pay as, John Parker built a lot of roads, but he did it in a pay as you go way, and you're never going to build a lot of roads doing it that way, especially in the Depression. And Long said, we can't wait, we got to borrow the money, we'll sell these bonds. And that's, he was attacked at the time for being fiscally irresponsible and reckless, but it's the way we do things now. It's considered standard procedure and a wise way to conduct government business. So he was ahead of his time.
So what were the, so he's governor, he's got the power, he's got the control. So what would be some of the, if you look at his early days and his early interest in LSU, what would have been some of the early things that he did for LSU?
Well, the first thing he did really, it's interesting. He didn't take a whole lot of interest in LSU in his first couple of years as governor. And I think that's because he was so busy fighting other fights, trying to keep himself from being impeached and just trying to get his program through. He spent some time at LSU, but he didn't try to run the university. And when he decided to do it in November, October, November of 1930, I mean, he just swooped in on this place and pretty much took it over in almost one day. There were a couple of things. There was a student, a law student that I write about in the book. His name is Kimball Kennedy, this young man from Farmerville, who Huey Long had known. And had represented him in a personal injury suit when the kid was much younger. He was an orphan, or at least his father had died, and Huey he was kind of a surrogate father to Kennedy. And he went to LSU, became student body president. He was very close to Long when he was in college. He was in some ways, I think, a spy for Long. He kept Long informed about what was going on campus. Then he goes to law school. He's the head of the law school student body. And he decides, and I think he lets Long know that the dean of this law school, Robert Lee Tullis, is an anti-Long. Kennedy and Long decide that Robert Lee Tullis is too old and needs to go, and they make a preemptive move on Tullis and try to get rid of him. The board is still not fully controlled by Long at that point. There's still appointees from the previous governor who are serving, so Long doesn't have the votes to get rid of this guy, but he makes it really clear that Tullis is going to, his days are short. And then he takes out after Thomas Atkinson, who's the president of the university, who, long story short, Kennedy does something, engages in some misconduct, gets expelled from the school a couple of weeks before he's supposed to graduate with his law degree. Long tries to get him reinstated and persuade Atkinson to give him his law degree, and Atkinson refuses to do that. And within a few months, Atkinson is gone. There's a new president. He fires the he arranges for the firing of the band director, and he tries to fire the football coach, and that's only foiled at the last minute when LSU almost beats Tulane in Tulane Stadium, and it saves the job of Russ Cohen, the football coach, for one more year. But it was it seems to be best I can tell, his interest in taking LSU, taking over LSU, was because he started trying to boss these people around and they resisted him. And I think he suddenly decided, well, I'll show them, and you know, I'll take over this university. By the next year, by the end of 1930, he had appointed a majority of the board, and he was fully in control of LSU at that point.
He was always interested in the band. That was important to him in developing LSU.
It was. It really was. He loved music. He thought he fancied himself a musician. He played the jew's harp, was the only instrument he played. But he thought he knew something about music. He wrote, he and Castro Carrazzo, who was the third band director under him and the one he personally hired in late 1934, they wrote songs together. They wrote Touchdown for LSU, and they wrote Every Man a King and a lot of other songs together. Huey would supposedly write the words, and Castro Carrazzo would supply the melody. He not only loved the band music, he loved Castro Carrazzo. When Carrazzo was the orchestra leader in the Fountain Room at the Roosevelt Hotel, he hung out there a lot and loved listening to that music. And he knew enough about music, I think, to recognize that the band, the LSU band at the time, the regimental band, really wasn't all that great. When Long became governor, I think there were only 37 band members. When he died, there were close to 200. So he really put a lot of emphasis on building up the band and making it a different kind of sound and a bigger sound. But he also recognized that the band could be part and parcel of the spectacle of LSU when it traveled for an away game. And so, you know, today if LSU goes to play in, you know, goes to Vanderbilt, goes to Nashville to play Vanderbilt, they fly in to the airport, you know, and they take a bus to the hotel. In those days, they took a train. And the big trip in 1934, when he takes the student body and the cadets and the band to the Vanderbilt game, they get to the train station in downtown Nashville, and they stage a parade, and it's quite a spectacle. Tens of thousands of people show up, wanting to see Huey Long, to see the band, to see LSU parade through the streets, and it really raised the profile of the university, and incidentally raises the profile of Huey Long.
Now, it's always an incredible story about bringing the whole student body to Nashville. They went up by train. Did they stay over at night, or did they go home after the game by train?
They went overnight. So they left on Friday afternoon and got there. It was an overnight train, so they roll into Nashville Saturday morning.
So they slept on the train.
They sleep on the train. They go to the game, and then they go back to the train station and ride the train back to Baton Rouge. So it was just, no one spent the night in Nashville. I mean, some people may have gotten off the train and stayed, but most people just got back on the train later that night and were back in Baton Rouge by about 3 o'clock the next afternoon.
Yeah, I guess back then beating Vanderbilt meant something. Today it wouldn't be. But LSU won, 29-0?
Yeah, they did. And Vanderbilt had a good team. They had a coach, Dan McGugin, who was one of the more respected football coaches in college football in those days, and was considered one of the masterminds. And for one reason or another, he and Huey Long became friends. And when Huey Long was shot, Dan McGugin, who was the Vanderbilt coach, one of LSU's fiercest rivals, rushed to Baton Rouge to offer to give blood for Huey. He was they became really good friends. Huey had went to when Huey was trying to convince the team, the coaches of the team, that he knew something about football, and he would always write up these plays. He went to McGugin and asked McGugin to give him a couple of plays that he could submit to the coaches to persuade them that he knew something about football.
So he went to the Vanderbilt coach to give him a play to give to the LSU coach.
And then he also went to there was a former quarterback for Tulane who was also a who was then an assistant coach, and incidentally an anti-Long member of the state House of Representatives, Lester Lautenschlager. I was speaking last night to a group in New Orleans, and a number of people knew this guy. He's in the College Football Hall of Fame. He somehow remained friends with this guy, even though this guy had voted for some of the articles of impeachment in 1929. And Huey goes to him and says, "I need some plays so that I can give to these coaches to make them." He wanted to know that these were really good plays, and he wanted to see if the coaches were blowing him off because they were from him or they were really bad plays. And I think that proved to him the coaches were kind of blowing him off because it was from him, not about the quality of the football plays he was submitting.
Lester Lautenschlager became the first director of the New Orleans Recreation Department.
Oh, did he really? Yeah.
That would have been under Delaceps Morrison, because it started under Morrison.
Uh-huh.
Morrison was trying to really reach out to the Central City kids and all that. And now that you tell me, because I never knew who he was, but now that you tell me he had an athletic background, he would have been a natural to say, let's put this guy in charge of legislation. And he was like for many years the head of it.
Ah, interesting. Yeah. So, you know, I just find it interesting that, you know, that Long somehow maintained a relationship with this person who was a political enemy. And it's, you know, sort of, it was kind of counterintuitive, but I think that, you know, football sort of their love of football sort of transcended things. And, you know, the thing it's, as you know, from reading the book that, you know, Long also supported Tulane football. I mean, he didn't get involved with the Tulane team to the extent that he got involved with LSU by any stretch of the imagination. But for the first few years of his governorship, he would, whenever LSU and Tulane would play, Long would spend the first half of the game on the LSU side. And then at halftime, he'd cross over and watch the game from the other side. In the beginning, he pretended that he was neutral. By the end of it, it was clear he was 100% LSU fan, but he still felt the need to cross over and sit with the LSU, the Tulane fans, because they were his constituents after all. And he had more of a connection with Tulane than he did with LSU. He actually took courses at Tulane. He never took a course at LSU.
Didn't he get his law degree from Tulane?
No, he took some, he went, he was sponsored by his brother Julius to go to New Orleans and take law school courses. So I think it was three or four courses that he takes at Tulane and then sits for the bar and passes the bar. But he never got a degree from Tulane undergraduate or law school.
So back then you didn't need to be a graduate of the law school. You
know? No, I think even into the 1960s or maybe 70s, but I know I think into the 60s if you could pass the bar exam, you didn't need to have a law degree in this state.
The you remind people a couple points in your book that for most of the early history of LSU that the school was segregated, as were all universities at the time. That would have been state law. It wouldn't have been
right.
Huey Long's law. No. And so, but we know that he was sort of like personally torn by the race issue. I think his passions were in favor of trying to do something, but the politics was pulling in a different direction.
Yeah, I think that Long was certainly not a race baiter like politicians in other states and some in Louisiana. Neither he or his brother Earl were really race baiters. I don't think they were all that, you know, they weren't enlightened. They weren't civil rights leaders. I don't want to portray Huey Long or Earl Long as anything other than pretty conventional Southern white supremacists. But they weren't they didn't exploit the issue like other Southern politicians did. And they also, they recognized that in a lot of cases, what they did, they helped black people as well as white people. Huey Long eliminated the poll tax in Louisiana, and that didn't really result in a lot of black people being registered to vote. A lot of poor whites got registered to vote, and I think that's probably more the reason why he did it. But it also potentially did help black people. And really the person who did the most, I think the Long who did the most for black people was Huey's younger brother Earl, who, when he was governor the first time in the 40s, late 40s, early 50s, increased the black voter registration by an enormous degree, like 100,000 black people in Louisiana registered to vote. It was the highest black registration in the South. And that's a pretty remarkable thing to happen 15 years or more before the passage of the Voting Rights Act.
Academically, was he really concerned about LSU, or was it just football?
No, I think he wanted it all. He would talk a lot about how that he was proud of having made LSU. He would exaggerate. He would say LSU is now on par with Yale and Harvard, and that was not true by any stretch of the imagination. He wanted LSU to not only have a good football team and a good band, but he wanted LSU to offer a good education to students, and he wanted good faculty. It didn't mean that, you know, he didn't. I don't think Huey really spent a lot of time thinking about, you know, who the English department's hiring, or do we have the right people teaching history, or whatever. That was beyond, I think, his expertise or even his interest. To the extent that he was concerned about the faculty, he was initially concerned that there were too many anti-Long people on the faculty. And James Monroe Smith, his hand-picked president, really did a pretty good job, I think, of protecting the faculty and assuring Huey. It's interesting. When Long wanted to fire a bunch of, you know, sort of fire, you know, run off all the anti-Long faculty, Smith said, instead, you know, my inclination might have been to lecture the governor on academic freedom. Smith was much smarter than me, and said, well, let me investigate and see if they really are anti-Long or not. And, you know, I doubt he really did much, but he comes back to Huey and says, I think that, you know, the faculty is really loyal to you. And Long let it go. And so, you know, he kind of left him alone. The only rule that Long had, and this, I mean, it's a gross violation of academic freedom and free speech, clearly, but the only thing that Long cared about was that faculty didn't attack him personally. You know, he didn't really care what you taught as long as you weren't teaching students to hate Huey Long. And I mean, that's clearly improper, but, you know, I think that's how a lot of faculty survived. They just didn't, you know, they kept their political activism under wraps or didn't engage at all. And even students knew this. You know, I have a whole chapter in the book about the Reveille 7, when these journalism students publish a letter to the editor that is only obliquely critical of Huey and not even mentioning him by name, and it resulted in the expulsion of 7 journalism students and the suspension of a couple of dozen who protested this violation of their free speech rights.
This became quite the story, that the journalism students were kicked out by the governor and the.
Yeah, it did, and it's a shameful episode, and the book as the story goes on in the book, and it comes to 1934, Huey's behavior becomes more and more erratic and more authoritarian across the board, but particularly at LSU. And so he's doing, by the end of 1934 and into 35, I think you can argue he's doing LSU more good than he's doing LSU more damage than good, because of his behavior and with the Reveille 7, with his behavior around trying to replace the law school, you know, run off the law school dean and then replace the law school dean, and some other stuff that he was doing. The accrediting body, the Southern accrediting body, the SACS organization, was coming after LSU, its accreditation. The accrediting body for the law school was investigating LSU and put LSU's law school on probation. I think if Huey had lived, it's very possible that LSU would have been unaccredited. And only his death in September of 1935 ended those two investigations and, you know, saved LSU from I think, some pretty serious damage.
Didn't Monroe Smith, I mean, his hand-picked president of LSU, didn't he wind up going to prison?
Yeah, so James Monroe Smith, who by all accounts was a pretty good president, a pretty efficient administrator and pretty creative guy, and and all of that toward the, you know, so we went, you know, Long, I quote Long on several occasions saying some variation of this, when I, if I die, all these guys are going to go to, all the people around me are going to end up going to prison because I won't be around to, you know, rein in their worst instincts. And I think James Monroe Smith was one of those people, with Long gone and no real heavy hand to rule the organization and keep everybody in line. You know, Smith began living a bigger life and, you know, a more expensive life, and got involved into buying stock and buying basically wheat futures and buying stock in whiskey companies and all this kind of stuff. And so he's getting in over his head, and to cover his losses or to cover his potential losses, he begins to falsify LSU board minutes to give himself a raise and other people a raise, but also to, most importantly, to falsify the existence of a bank loan that he claims that LSU had authorized. And so he goes to the bank with the board minutes to get a couple $100,000 bank loan for the university, but it's really for him to cover his stock speculation losses. And he gets away with it for a while, but it finally, you know, it all comes out in 1939, and he dramatically skips town and flees to Canada, and is finally apprehended in Canada and extradited back to New Orleans and then to Baton Rouge and goes to prison.
You know, there was a gentleman who I got to know in his old age, and we talked several times. His name was Carl Carbon. And he was one of the students who was expelled from LSU. But anyway, he went on to journalism. He, I think it was with the Picayune, but anyway, he became a distinguished journalism career. And he told the story that the day that Monroe Smith came back from prison, and he flew back into New Orleans at the Lakefront Airport, and he was a reporter, and he covered the story. And he went up and interviewed him and asked him all kinds of stories about what he'd done and what was wrong. Well, anyway, Smith became kind of indignant and said, "Young man, you're being very impertinent." And then Corbin identified him as being one of the students that he'd been responsible for kicking out.
Yeah.
And that was, I guess, a good moment of revenge, but he always told that story about getting the last draw on Monroe Smith.
Yeah, he says something like, you know, he keeps asking his questions and Smith won't answer him, and he finally says, "You're very impertinent. I don't know who you are," or something like that. And he says, "Oh, I'm surprised you don't remember me. You kicked me out of LSU a few years ago."
Yeah, he was always proud of that moment. Just a couple of other things I want to ask you about. The you'd mentioned Every Man a King, and this was so Huey Long spent a lot of time at the Roosevelt Hotel.
Mm-hmm.
He liked music, as you pointed out. He was a big fan of the orchestra lead at the Fountain Lounge, and brought him eventually to Baton Rouge to direct an LSU band. But he also had, this is Castro Carrozzo, but he and Carrozzo worked on songs together. And one of them, the most famous, would be Every Man a King. And as I understand that, Long would come up with the lyrics and Carrozzo would put it into music. And there was a famous clip of Huey. He was in New York. He was a club or something, and he was, Every Man a King was performed. I think the guy on the piano was Carrozzo. I'm not sure. Someone is singing. I thought it was Carrozzo, but it might not have been him or not. I don't know. But certainly it was he and Carrozzo that were there. And I just want to play just a few bars. This is Huey Long. And this was back when they used to make, there wasn't TV news. So they had these movie news companies that go around. Whenever there's something going on, they do a little film about it, and they show it in the movies. And so while this is going on, Huey Long, who's delighted, he's kind of dancing along to the song. And so it's a little bit of Every Man a King, written by Huey Long with music by Castro Carrozzo.
That's right. I weep or slumber, America, land of brave and true, with castles and clothing and food for all belongs
king, for you can be a millionaire. That's fine. But there's something belonging to others. There's enough for all people to share. When it's sunny June and December.
So I'm sure you're familiar with that clip.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think, by the way, I don't think that's, I don't believe that's Carrazzo. That's somebody else playing.
He seemed like a New York kind of guy, the kind of guy singing in the hotel in New York, but that certainly became his anthem. And of course, the song had a revival in what, in the 70s when Randy Newman.
Yes.
In the album with a bigger orchestration. But that whole, this is a little bit away from LSU, but the whole Every Man a King revival, the whole populist revival, is that Huey Long was really a leader in the nationwide populism movement.
Yeah, he was. And, you know, he was clearly inching toward running for president in 1936. And a lot of people think that he would have and very likely would have not been elected, but very likely would have prevented Franklin Roosevelt from being reelected. Some people think that he hoped to prevent Roosevelt from being reelected so that he could, 4 years later, after a Republican president presided over the disaster that I think he would have anticipated, he could come back and be the savior of the country. But he did not live to do any of that. But he was clearly preparing for it, because Every Man a King was a song that he wanted to be the anthem of his, Share Our Wealth Society, which was a national organization that he created to build support for his tax plan. But I think it was clearly the precursor of a presidential campaign.
He did write a book called My First Days in the White House. So that'll kind of tip you off right there.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. That's a hint.
Yeah, where he announces who his appointments would be and so.
Yeah. It was meant as a funny. It's a funny book because he's got all these characters from the Roosevelt administration serving under him and giving them menial jobs and everything. It's meant to be sort of ridiculing his political adversaries.
Well, I'll play one more clip just for fun. This was the calling Baton Rouge. This is the big song by Garth Brooks. It's not about LSU per se, but I understand it's played over and over during the LSU games. That's like when the teams, like at breaks and all of this, that they
play. It's played one time during every game, but it's a big moment during every game.
Okay, and it's got this rollicking fiddle section at the beginning, and the crowd goes crazy.
Yes. Yep.
For those who are deprived of it, I just want to play a little bit of it. But anyway, this is Garth Brooks calling Baton Rouge.
Of a girl in Louisiana. Though I'm out on the highway, my thoughts are still with her. Such a strange combination of a woman and a child. Such a strange situation, stopping every 100 miles, calling Baton Rouge. A replay of last night's events roll through my mind. Except a scene or two erased by sweet red wine. And I see a truck stop sign.
Were you at that concert?
I was. My wife and I went with our two children. We had a blast.
Okay. I'm told, so maybe you can verify, that the one of the LSU departments was able to measure the noise level when they played that song.
Yeah.
Equal to a Category 1 earthquake or something.
Yeah, it registered on the seismograph. It was similar to the big earthquake game against Auburn, and a couple of decades ago. But it was an amazing moment when he started singing. You couldn't hear Garth Brooks sing almost anything from the beginning to the end of that concert. Everybody sang along. Everybody knew every song, and everybody sang along from every song. My children really didn't know much about Garth Brooks, especially my son, and they were both agog at the whole thing. They were like, My goodness, this is amazing. They just had no idea how popular he was. They knew the song, but they didn't really know what he was, that he was such a big deal otherwise, outside of singing that one song.
You know, Jim Brown, former Secretary of State and insurance commissioner, he tells the story that when he was first elected Secretary of State, he'd go around, he'd be invited to speak to different organizations and talk about the state. And that one Saturday night, he was at one of the places in one of the Florida parishes, one of those parishes, and he went to talk early on Saturday evening. He was driving back to Baton Rouge, he hadn't eaten, so he stopped at this kind of like this bar restaurant called like the Bear Trap or something. It was kind of a kind of big place. And so he'd go at the bar he was eating, and they had this country singer on the stage, and this was these kind of things where they had chicken wire separating the audience.
Right.
Yeah. Because of people throwing bottles. And he asked the bartender, who is it? He says, what's the guy named Garth Brooks? He says, the guy from Oklahoma. He comes by from time to time. And the bartender says, you know, he's going to probably go places, you know. So can you imagine? He first saw Garth Brooks on that stage at the Bear Trap. And,
that's great.
Being protected by tell us about your book. Is it? It's out there now.
Yeah, it's out. It's out and about. So you can get it. Technically, it's technically not published until June 7th. So if you order it from Amazon or Barnes and Noble or one of those places, they may not get it to you as quickly. But it's a lot of the local independently owned bookstores have it in the New Orleans area. The gift shop at the Jazz Museum down. I was just there last night, and they have a good inventory of it. Or you can get a signed copy from me directly at kingfishu.com. And but it's out. It's pretty much out everywhere.
And it's published by LSU Press. Well, LSU Press is doing a lot of stuff. I mean, we have books that go through, and so it's
a great press, and they're great people to work with. This is my fourth or fifth book with them, and I love working with the people over there. I think they design beautiful books, which is one of my favorite aspects of it. Is they just do a really, they produce really beautiful books.
They're doing a whole series, a special set on cocktails.
Yeah.
And, we've had a couple of people on the show, and they're nice and on books, but your book is really nice. It's a good, it's a good read. A lot of stories. Photographs and everything. So, what's next?
Well, I'm finishing up the first draft. Hopefully, by the end of June, I'll be finished with the first draft of it, of a book. The working title is "You Are My Sunshine: Jimmy Davis and the Biography of an American Song."
Okay, so and when did it come out?
It'll be out probably in 2025.
Okay. All right. Did he actually write it?
No, that's part of the story, is figuring out who wrote it.
Yeah.
And I think I know who wrote it, but I'm confident I know who didn't write it. And one of those people was Jimmy Davis. He did not write the song, but he was happy to let people think that he did. And he claimed that he did on numerous occasions, but he did not write the song, but it became his song, and he owned the song. He bought the song. So he made a lot of money off that song. But it's really about, you know, the provenance of the song, but the book is also about how he used the song politically in his campaigns, and how others adopted the song, and just, you know, the various incarnations of the song. So it's sort of quasi partial biography of Davis, but really more about the impact of the song in Louisiana and beyond. It's you know, it's a crazy thing. It's the state, one of the state songs of Louisiana, but it's also an enormously popular song in places like Japan. It became one of the more popular songs of British and American soldiers in England during the Second World War. It was reportedly Churchill's favorite song.
Really?
So it just has a big cultural reach, and that's really the focus of the book.
And he has a bridge name now. I hate to come back to Jim Brown, but I'm sorry, it just comes to mind. He also has a story that when he was a young state legislator, where was he, in Faraday?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay. And Jimmy Davis was living around there.
Where Jimmy Davis had a farm in Newellton.
Okay, no, but anyway, he said, Jimmy Davis got in this habit, like he'd be driving back to Baton Rouge, and he'd stop at his office in Faraday, use the bathroom.
Yep.
And so they got to know each other.
Yeah.
That. And then, and he says, anyway, Jimmy Davis had him come over to sign some documents in the governor's office and all that. But he says this one day, Jimmy Davis said, look, you've been so good to me. Is anything I can do for you? And he said, well, would you mind singing a little bit of You're My Sunshine? And I think he was carrying his guitar with him, and he sat in there and he sang You Are My Sunshine, too. Well, so.
Yeah, and I believe if, you know, Jim, I think if I recall correctly, Jim says that that happened one time, and then Davis, I can't remember if it was in his office or maybe when he went to see Jimmy Davis at his house in Baton Rouge, but Jim claims that he was the last person to hear Jimmy Davis sing You Are My Sunshine.
Well, that was your story. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Errol. It's been a pleasure, as always. Thank you so much for your for your interest in my work.
Okay, thank you. Well, it's good work. That's why we're interested, so.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Louisiana Insider. Subscribe, like, and rate our show where you listen to your podcasts, and follow us on social media at Louisiana Life Mag. Executive producer for Louisiana Insider is Kelly Massico, in cooperation with Louisiana Life Magazine. For subscription information to Louisiana Life, call 504-828-1380. Our theme music was provided by Rich Collins. Hey, that's me. Join us again next week for more discoveries inside Louisiana.